Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
What an eventful week we've had. Following on the 11th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, the United States has yet again witnessed hostility directed its way with protests against and assaults on our diplomatic missions in Egypt, Yemen, Sudan, and Libya. The latter attack resulted in the death of four U.S. personnel, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens. We are recording this interview on the afternoon of Friday, September 14th, just 3 days after these events, and it is difficult to say for certain what caused this conflict. Nonetheless, the attacks themselves raise an interesting challenge to Christians, particularly those who hold strongly to the exhortation of Jesus that is reported in Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 to 45, and I quote, "You have heard that it was said, 'Love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven." Unquote. This more pacifistic and forgiving response to conflict can be tested mightily in situations such as the terrorist attacks of 9/11 or even following a raid on a U.S. embassy, particularly when such conflict seems to be motivated by religious conflict itself. To discuss the issue of terrorism and how Christians can respond in a world where such conflict seems inevitable without resorting to further violence, I am pleased to be joined today by Dr. Ron Mock, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon. Professor Mock is the author of Loving Without Giving In: Christian Responses to Terrorism and Tyranny. He has also recently co-authored a book on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict entitled When the Rain Returns: Towards Justice and Reconciliation in Israel and Palestine. We will link to both of these books on our website. I should also note that Ron has had other experience in the realm of conflict resolution, as he holds a law degree from the University of Michigan and has worked within the Christian Reconciliation Movement that promotes peaceful resolution to conflict, a topic that we recently featured on our podcast. This experience has led him to hold the directorship of the Center for Peace and Justice at George Fox University, a position that he has been in since 1990. Ron, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you.
Hey, I know our listeners are very interested in this topic of terrorism. It always generates a lot of media attention and hits to our website, and we want to talk about how we deal with that problem. But before we dive into that pool, I want to explore a couple thoughts and reactions that you might have to several situations here. And the first of these situations doesn't really involve terrorism at all, but it was a topic that it was a topic of discussion a few months back on our show when I had three separate scholars, including your colleague, George Fox here, Mark David Hall, and we got them together and we asked them whether or not they would have picked up arms against King George during the U.S. War of Independence. Now, admittedly, I was quite surprised to find so many Christian scholars who would not have gone to war or not would have picked up arms. Was quite surprised by this, and it was a very interesting podcast. We'll again link to that for our listeners. But I want to pose that question to you. This is a little bit removed from terrorism, I know, but I kind of probe your ideas of, you know, where do you think violent conflict has a position or not at all? So Ron, I pose this question to you. Would you have joined the Continental Army or any colonial militia back in 1775 following the battles of Lexington and Concord?
No, I would not.
Okay, explain that to me. Why would that be the case?
Well, I can do it at two levels. For me, the most fundamental one comes because I think the command that you cited earlier, that Jesus gave us to love our enemies, is incompatible with the idea of killing them. I think you could even go deeper in that and say that the act of killing for a Christian is an act of despair, an act of saying that God cannot reach and redeem some person, that God is done with them and ready to toss them. And I think that's unbiblical. So the whole idea of responding to that violently would have been a fairly quick decision, I think, for me, in the sense that I long ago decided that I would not participate in warfare. I think it's a problem even from just war theory. If you were coming from that point of view for the revolution, I think we could make an argument against participation in just war. But for a pacifist, it would... I want to say for a pacifist, it wouldn't have been a very close decision, although the Quakers themselves at the time were divided, and some people at the time felt that it was so important to participate in the common enterprise of the American colonies that they became fighting Quakers, and or sometimes calling themselves free Quakers, so that there was a division amongst Quakers. But for me, I don't really understand why that... If we have a particular commitment to pacifism, if we've concluded that God calls us to love our enemies, that doesn't mean much if when the rubber meets the road, we say, oh, well, that I guess I was wrong.
Yeah, or that there's an exception here or
yes,
such that.
Exactly.
You just brought up something that I want our listeners to be aware of. We're at George Fox University recording this today, and George Fox University is associated with the Religious Society of Friends, who are also known as the Quakers. So let me... Before we probe you a little bit more on your reaction to terrorism, and then also I still want to stay on this question of the U.S. Revolutionary War, give us a little bit about your background. Were you raised as a Quaker?
No, I was raised in the Church of God, Anderson, Indiana, which is almost a perfect example of a standard evangelical denomination. Although it had, in its early days, the Church of God did, back in the late 19th century, a strong pacifist trend, and was the official doctrine of the... Well, they don't really have official doctrines of the Church of God, but as far as a sort of a majority view in the church. By the time I was a kid in the 60s and the 70s, that had diminished, and you wouldn't be able to tell a Church of God position on war from any Wesleyan or evangelical other group. So pretty, but my family still had a strain of that, and so my grandfather in particular was a pacifist during World War II, and I had an uncle that refused induction during the Korean War era because of his beliefs, and so things like that. So it was in my family, but as a personal conviction, I suppose it developed in my college years. I was just young enough to miss the end of the Vietnam War, but we had to make a decision about how to register. We had to register, obviously. We had to make a decision how to register. And at that time, I had to think through what I really believed. And so I registered as CO in 73.
As CO being a conscientious objector.
Yeah. In 74, I guess, was the year I had to register. Yeah.
Okay, so you register as a conscientious objector. Now, I'm just going to ask this. This is kind of a little bit of a personal question, but and this might relate to your uncle or other members of your family too. Was this really deeply rooted in your religious convictions, or were, back in the Vietnam War era, there was a lot of people that said, hey, I just don't want to go because it's pretty scary over there, so you know, I'll sign up to be a Quaker or something along that lines? Was there...
like I said, in my particular family, we understood that the command to love our enemies meant we couldn't kill them. I mean, it was a pretty simple idea. And in a way, I just returned to that simple idea today. But yeah, it was definitely rooted in my faith.
In deep faith. Now, you said you belonged to the Church of God, but now you're a member of the Society of Friends or Quakers.
Yeah.
How did that transformation come about?
Well, I came to George Fox as an undergraduate. I was here back in the mid-70s as a student and encountered Quakers. And I thought that they did a better job than the church I grew up in of integrating a more holistic gospel, not just about personal piety, but about responsibility to society. I think if I had fallen in amongst the Mennonites soon enough, I might have been one of those instead. But
okay, you just happened to
Quakers where I was.
So you were an undergraduate at George Fox University, now a professor. It was kind of a welcome back Connor situation.
I guess so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's interesting that your pacifism in many ways might have led your religious preferences rather than vice versa. Is that a way of saying that, or at least in terms
well,
of...
Well, you'd have to say it's more recursive, because the pacifism comes out of religious training.
Right, out of the Church of God.
At least in the particular way that I was brought up in the Church of God.
Okay. And so I also have to ask as a Quaker, and again, the Quakers never called themselves the Quakers when they originally came out. They were the Society of Friends, but
yes.
I think this was in the, you know, roughly the later 1600s in England.
Yes.
They were known as Quakers because they would jump around and shake and jump and shout, much like Pentecostals might do today. So have you been known to quake at all?
No, I haven't ever seen anybody actually quake. And as I understood it, it might not be quite that dramatic. It might be just sitting and quaking, but still, I've never actually seen it. It's pretty much an anachronism now.
Okay. So Let's go back again to, you had mentioned about the U.S. Revolutionary War, the U.S. War of Independence, that you would not have chosen. It would have been a pretty quick decision for you based upon your pacifism. But you also know that, hey, there were Quakers that did pick up arms, the fighting Quakers, the free Quakers. You also said something there that I want to probe a little bit more deeply about the just war, right? So you said, well, maybe even the U.S. War of Independence wouldn't have been justified based upon just war theory. Explain that a little bit.
I think I do it on two levels. Just war requires a just cause to begin with. And I'm with the Americans in that in general justice is on their side. But to overthrow a sitting government, it seems to me that even in general political theory, but certainly in just war theory, there has to be an extremely strong case that the government has served so badly that it's really no better than no government. I mean, I'm going back to Thomas Hobbes in this. And the complaints that the colonists had against England and the crown were in many cases legitimate. But when you read the Declaration of Independence, it's kind of a trumped up case.
Oh, yeah, that everybody does that to make their case, right?
So I don't know that I would have been able to be convinced as a just warrior. That was my position, that we had reached a just cause for overthrowing a sitting government. Now, but secondarily, I think the other problem is the last resort issue. There was political movement in England at the time sympathetic to the colonists. And that's despite, even after the colonists rebelled, it seems to me that the sympathetic movement couldn't have been sustained better and that the political political system hadn't really been tested and pushed to its limit. And furthermore, although it's a little hard to make this criticism for the late 18th century because they hadn't had the experience that 19th and 20th century people did with active nonviolence, I think that it was a prime opportunity for an active nonviolent revolution if you needed it.
What would that have looked like?
That's an interesting question. In the 18th century, you don't have the modern means of communication that seems so important. And so it would have to look a little different. The way I speculate about this is to imagine that John Woolman, the old Quaker, had lived just a few years longer. He died in 1775, I believe it was, in England, visiting Quakers there. He got smallpox and died. But he was in his late 50s or something. It wouldn't have been beyond the realm of possibility that he could have lived 10 years longer and been an active leader in a nonviolent movement. So I tried to put, what would John Woolman do? Sort of WWJWD, something.
That would be a long rubber bracelet on your arm, I guess.
Right.
So how would that look? I mean, you could put rubber bracelets on your arm, like, you know, Lance Armstrong's Live Strong thing, and we can show our solidarity with that.
Right.
But, you know, what, I mean, weren't the colonists at that time trying that? They were trying to, you know, skirt around the policies they didn't like in terms of taxation or the quartering of soldiers or things like that. What would it look like?
I think it would be the kind of extensive nonviolent, non-cooperation type of thing that Gandhi or King might have done. So if you want to see rough analogies of what might have happened in the 1770s and 80s to get independence. And remember, it took us 8 years if you count 1775. I don't think it would have been any quicker, but nonviolence might have been slower. But repeated non-cooperation with the things that were unjust, we dabbled in that. I don't think you could say we had any long period of doing that. I mean, a tea party here, a Stamp Act resistance there, a trial there. It was just barely beginning to touch the surface of what we could have done. So there was a detour, it seems to me, into the violent response, partly provoked by the British, but we didn't have to take that provocation.
Now, let me ask this, because I think this question, or at least this theme, will hang around when we start talking about terrorism a little bit more as well, is the question that I posed to the scholars who were on the podcast a couple months ago on this topic was that we're looking at this in 2020 hindsight.
Oh,
is it a little bit easier for us to say, well, no, that really wasn't a just war because your tax burden was actually pretty small and compared to what we have today. And wow, you just seem like a bunch of whiners now. And if you would have just lasted a little bit longer, like Gandhi or somebody,
we're saying this before Gandhi. So I have to recognize
exactly.
This is a problem. Yeah, well, it's always easier in 2020 hindsight, but that doesn't really excuse the people at the time. Excuses, I don't want to blame the people at the time. I'm not saying that they're evil people. I mean, obviously, for the most part, they were trying to do the best with what they could. But and it would have taken more imagination in 1775 and 6 to do this than it would take now. And that's a higher burden because we didn't have a lot of history to draw on. The Quakers had been running Pennsylvania, but there were compromises for a couple generations with their nonviolence in the running of Pennsylvania. So there, I mean, there's just the body of evidence that they'd have to say, yeah, we can do this and it can work, would have been less than what we have now. I agree.
And could the Quakers have done it by themselves? Because no. They were largely concentrated in Pennsylvania, and you had
Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Virginia, but yes, not everywhere.
Yeah, not everywhere. But, you know, and a lot of the people who came to the colonies were not necessarily religious. We have the vision of the pilgrims and everybody comes to escape religious persecution, but a lot of these people were 20-some-year-old single males that wanted to get rich quick. And those are not the churchy type. And they would, how would they have been drawn into a nonviolent movement like this? And
well, it's a problem. It's a political problem that, in terms of the sort of domestic politics, it's the same kind of problem that Martin Luther King or a Gandhi particularly would have had. I mean, Gandhi's importing his ideas of nonviolence into India, into maybe even more barren soil than we would have had then. So that's. Those are real concerns. It would have been difficult to imagine. But on the other hand, of all the English colonies, which other ones had a war of revolution?
Well, Canadians didn't. The Australians did not. So
there were insurrectionists in Kenya, but even they didn't win as a war.
Yeah.
So we were first. That's to help excuse our behavior, I guess, in a sense.
But could that also have been, we were the first ones, and now all of a sudden this adjust the calculations that the Crown has to make? Is that, oh, we don't want to have to go through that again with the Canadians or the Australians or any of the other colonies, or India again. So maybe they were more likely, the British were more likely to give up without a fight than had we not gone to war.
It's possible. And the other possibility would have been that we would not have gotten independence exactly. We would have been maybe gained some more representation in Parliament or some other adjustment that would have dealt with our concerns. I mean, it's hard to say that the average British citizen on the island of England would have had reason to rebel. And so if we had been brought to the level of them that they enjoyed in the late 18th century, it may have taken longer. We may not have been independent until, who knows, 1830, 1840, maybe when the Canadians got it. Mm-hmm. Would that have been so bad? Was it worth the hundred, what, thousands, tens of thousands of deaths in that war? I don't know how many there were. Was it worth setting the precedent for the Civil War? The Civil War rises directly out of our experience in the Revolutionary War. The whole explanation for the South for why it was okay to do what they did was because we did it previously to set up the United States of America.
Yeah, and there was a compromise in order to create a union and
everything
et cetera, et cetera.
We do has reverberations. When Peter strikes the ear off the temple guard, Jesus says, put that sword away. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And one of the ways I understand that is you create the reality that you deal with. If Peter succeeds in repelling the attack by cutting off one ear, what are the temple guards going to do next time? They'll come with more people and more weapons. And how would the Peters of the world have to respond with increasing military weapons anyway, more violently? And I think Jesus is telling us we create the reality around us. I think sociologists call this structuration. We in the way we act, we create the patterns of behavior, the norms, the expectations, even the institutions and structures around us. And when we decided that we were going to win our independence as a country from Britain violently, we created precedent. And we created attitudes, and we even created structures that led directly to the Civil War. And again, we were the only major country that had a war to end slavery. And I think we created that when we did the Civil War, I mean, the Revolution. Now, I could say that now as an historical argument, people will question it. It would be very hard to imagine it in 1775, 76, that what we're doing now is setting up a Civil War. But still, I mean, that's part of the reason why we have to, yeah, I think from a Christian perspective, we have to be consistent in obeying the light as we see it, even if we don't understand it entirely. And so if I had believed, as I believe now, that killing enemies is not loving them, I think it was my responsibility to live by that, even though I don't know the entire consequence. But that's the sort of the notion for Christians, is that God does know, and that's how we avoid those long-term consequences that we can't imagine now.
Well, let's do that, because we were playing a historical game here, a little discussion of what if in terms of the U.S. War of Independence, and we know what came out of that, but now we're in the contemporary times, and yes, we're dealing with issues of terrorism, and there's a new threat. The world has changed since 9/11, and some people may even go back to the 1970s with the onset of the first airline hijackings, mm-hmm, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So let's explore that, and that's what primarily we want to do here today. But a lot of what we talked about just now, I think, sets this up too. Let me start again by focusing a little bit on the psychological reactions to some of these tragedies, because I think the emotions that we feel in some of these times oftentimes directs how we react, yes, to these things. And so I'm going to ask you the quintessential September 11th question. And that question is, where were you when you heard the news, and how did you react?
Well, when I heard the news, it was from my wife, who had been out running. See, this is, we are on the West Coast here, so it was early in the morning for us, our time. My wife had been out running. It was a beautiful September day, like today, like that day. We had the same weather here as they were having in New York, mm-hmm, that day. And she came in at whenever she was done running, and I was still lounging around in bed. And she said, "You need to go watch the TV." And I said, "Why?" "Well, somebody's flown a plane into a building in New York." So I got up and watched TV. I watched TV all day. I didn't come into the office. I had no classes that day. I watched TV the whole day. Well into the night, around about 2 in the morning, I started writing. And the book I wrote about terrorism was written. About 30% of it was written in the next 2 weeks, late at night. So that is... But I haven't given you my initial reaction. That's my second reaction.
Okay. Yeah.
My initial reaction was anger.
So you were angry.
Yeah, very angry, yes.
Okay, yeah, because I will share my situation too. Again, we're on the West Coast, and so when all this starts to happen, we're in the process of waking up here on, yeah, the Pacific Coast. And my wife, same thing. She says, she usually gets up before me. She says, "You got to watch the television. An airplane has flown into the World Trade Center." I thought it was one of these little Piper Cubs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some guy had a heart attack and he ran into the thing. And, you know, for the first half hour, it didn't quite register what happened, right? And then the second one hits, and then the Pentagon, and then you hear of another one over the course of, you, yeah, know, the next hour or two.
Yeah.
And yeah, my reaction too was to, first of all, shock. You almost kind of go into shock, was, wow, this could not really be happening. But that next thing is anger, yeah, right? And for me, and I'm not a Quaker, I'm not a pacifist, I would have picked up arms during the U.S. Revolutionary War. Mine was kind of the Annie, get your gun kind of response, is that, yeah, somebody's going to pay for this, right? And let's go get them, guys. So you experienced anger, right? But did you have that secondary feeling of, okay, I'm angry, let's go punch somebody now?
Yeah, but you're not going to like my account of it, because, okay, I did have that, but I felt atavistic about it. I felt like this was not my best, who I was called to be.
Well, it's definitely a time of testing for us, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody can be angry. Anybody, yep, can lose their temper. I lose my temper more often than I should. But I didn't have somebody there to punch.
Yeah.
So there was no way for me to immediately carry out my anger.
Yeah, definitely. So, when I was saying that, I didn't mean somebody there at that moment, but we're going to gun up in the next couple of weeks and take care of this problem, right?
Right. And so I'm very familiar with that impulse. I mean, I have that impulse.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I shouldn't be giving in to all my impulses. I would not have a very successful life.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah, yeah. And that is very interesting. And this is what this question was really meant to probe at, because when folks who, I don't hang with too many pacifists, or at least I don't think I do, maybe they are, I just don't know. But when we think about pacifists, we kind of think about people who never get angry. They're always happy, and you know, life is filled with strawberry-scented unicorns, and nothing is ever wrong. But no, there is. I'm interested to hear that. Yeah, you had that reaction too, and you say you don't want to give in to your impulse, and so that those times must be a real challenge, right? Spiritually,
yeah, they are.
Intellectually, emotionally.
Well, and also to feel responsible. One of my critiques of pacifists and pacifism is that for most of its history, it's been, what's the word I want? It's sheltered itself from responsibility. When the Quakers trying to run Pennsylvania as a pacifist colony, with all the compromises, it was still a three-generation attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, we don't really have anybody trying to run a polity where they're responsible for public order and do it with a pacifist thing. And the problem for a pacifist ruler or a pacifist political leader is that while it's true that Jesus told him he needs to love his enemies, and therefore it's very difficult to imagine how you can kill them, it's also true that he said you need to love your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And your neighbors are relying on you to keep the criminals from running into the houses and stealing them blind or killing them or raping them. And they're relying on you to keep foreign enemies from tromping through your territory and burning it to the ground, mm-hmm. Sherman style, or whatever it is they might do. And so you're stuck in the middle of these two commands. How do you love your enemies and your neighbors? I like to think about this as a thought experiment for Constantine, the Roman emperor, who's certainly not a pacifist. I mean, he's a classic. He's a military man. He comes up through the military. His dad was too, and he's good at it. And Maxentius is in Rome, declaring himself illegitimate, even more illegitimately than Constantine himself did, to be an emperor. And he's causing trouble, and he's likely to start a civil war. And meantime, in many ways, the Romans are suffering. And so he needs to do something about it. He's responsible to them. He's got a big army waiting to go in. And he has this vision where he says he sees Christ's cross and under this sign conquer. And supposedly this starts his conversion to Christianity. And I want to say, well, what happens if that's a legitimate conversion to Christianity? At that point, Christianity is a majority pacifist religion. Now there's debates within the faith about this, but the leadership is pretty clear that this is, we don't kill our enemies. So what if he takes that seriously? What can he do? This is one of the big pacifist dilemmas, it seems to me. If you find yourself suddenly in position of a political leadership and there's unrest or threats to public order, how do you love both the enemy and the neighbor? Yeah. And my critique is that pacifists have never really managed that question. Constantine doesn't even think about it very long, apparently. He just goes ahead the next day and starts the battle against Maxentius and eliminates him from Rome. And immediately, almost immediately, the church kind of flips on the just war versus pacifism. Well, they're not just war yet. Augustine has to help with that. And
we don't
get that all the way down until the Middle Ages. But to something else other than pacifism. And since then, pacifists have often chosen to separate themselves. As I said earlier, if I'd met the Mennonites earlier, I might have been a Mennonite. My critique of the Mennonites historically has been that they've run away from political authority. They've pretended, even in democracies, that they have none, which isn't true. In any democracy, you have one, even political authority. Even if you refuse to vote, it's a way of exercising your rights. So I've been worried about how pacifism can be more responsible. I've written another book which hasn't been published yet. I'm looking for a publisher. And the title is Pacifism Under Pressure. And this is the pressure I think it's under. One way of saying it is the pressure it's under is that how can it be responsible in situations where clearly there are threats, real threats. Like, we can't just wish them away. There are real threats. Terrorism now. I mean, there are still people, lots of people around the world, if they can get a nuke, they're going to use it. And we have to deal with that responsibly.
Yeah, let's probe that paradox a little bit more. And I'm glad you brought that up because this is a really thoughtful response to the situation. And the question I would probe you on this here is pacifism easier because you do have that surrounding institutional structure that will take care of things? You know, for instance, let's give you a scenario. You're walking down the street and your neighbor is being attacked by some big bad dude.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so you have your neighbor there that you have to love. You have the enemy there that's pummeling them. And my gosh, that person could kill my neighbor or do serious damage to them. And you're at a point where you have to make a choice and you say, well, you know, if I intervene, I'm going to have to get in a fist fight. There's going to have to be some fist because they're going to be coming back at me, and there are those natural reactions that we're going to do that. But you know what? There's a policeman only a block down the road. So I can call them, satisfy my pacifist leanings, and yet do the right thing and that. But then again, what if there was no police within 10 square miles?
Yeah, well, this is a good analogy. I think it's clear that the neighbor does have, the pacifist neighbor, any neighbor, has a duty, a moral duty to intervene in a situation like that. And I think it extends to the international realm. And so I'll come back to that later if you'd like.
Yeah.
There's a similar duty.
Well, this is definitely setting up the international realm right now.
And I'm first going to shave pieces off your question, okay?
Okay, fair enough.
First, I'm going to say there's never just two options. I don't have to shoot the assailant or run away. I mean, there are other options. And actually getting a police officer is an option and actually reduces the chance of anybody getting killed, hopefully, if the police officer is doing his job right. So that's an option. So I don't want – one of the first responses I have about these dilemmas is to say, well, we're going to look for other ways. And I say that partly because of a faith position I have that God does love everybody and doesn't give up on anybody. And so there must be a way because God's omnipotent, so things are possible. The other thing is a sort of a practical observation that reinforce at all kinds of levels, from the study of human history to the study of people in laboratory situations where they're presented with problems. And that is, we tend in times of crisis not to be real creative. And so we tend to use, the research says that in immediate crisis, we tend to lose sight of options. We tend to be very poor at accurately perceiving what's going on and intentions and everything. So we're not at our best decision-making. So that's when we tend to think that we only have one or two choices. So one of the responsible things that anybody should have, not just pacifists, should do is to plan ahead, think about these things at a time when you're not in a crisis, because then you might be able to see some more creative options. So I'm going to resist any kind of bipolar, there's only one or two things you can do.
Interesting. I just have to do a side note here because we did a podcast about a year ago on martial arts, and I happen to be a martial artist. And I hear what you're saying is that you get into a situation of conflict. We go on mats and we do tournament fights and that. And everything you learn basically comes down to two things, right? You all of a sudden, do I kick now or do I not kick now? And you go back to very basic instincts in those times. Your blood pressure goes up and adrenaline is pumping and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right, is that part of the martial arts training is for you to think through all the different scenarios so that you don't leave yourself just with two options. And the better you get at that, you do see other options for this. And again, now we're using a situation, it's on the street. There's a strong imperative that if you don't do something in the next minute, something bad's going to happen. Yeah. We're going to kick this up to the international level where there's more time for thought and strategizing a little bit. But go ahead. Any final thoughts on that?
No, I haven't cut the other almost half of your question. Yeah. There's going to be a nub left. You'll be happy. But
okay.
The other half of it is that my understanding of pacifism is that it's based on love. And you can do things to people that you love, short of killing them, that is still coercive and maybe even hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's possible to spank a child when you love them. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible to restrain somebody. I mean, just grab them, tackle them when you love them. What's difficult for a Christian pacifist is to remove the person's chance of redemption and consider that consistent with love. So anything short of lethal violence, in my book, is open to a pacifist. Now, there's a problem.
I want to say that's a very good point to make. And go ahead and repeat that, because I want to make sure that my listeners get that. Pacifism doesn't mean you just sit like a mushroom on the ground.
Right. It's not passive. There is dispute amongst pacifists about how far pacifism should go. I tend to be, there are some people who think that any sort of violence is unloving. I don't take that position. I think there are forms of violence that are loving, and particularly in a situation like what you're describing, when you're trying to prevent what might be a death, it's possible to love the assailant and still coerce the assailant and to hold him against his will, do things that might hurt him. And so I would say anything short of lethal violence is open to a pacifist, but it's not as easy as that, because there's an escalation process. And so if he's just pounding with fists and I come with a big metal rod and try to beat the assailant into submission without killing him somehow, well, his response will be to arm up, maybe take the rod away from me.
Yeah, 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 beat harder, right, exactly. Yeah.
And so you have to take that into account. And so you, but still, so I'm, it'd be perfectly within my realm of possibility to tackle the assailant and try to turn into a 2-to-1 fist fight. Mm-hmm. Or to do something else that would try to restrain the assailant, and or to be more creative and try to figure out ways to distract or remove the attention of the assailant from this position so that the whole thing is deflected. But I mean, I'd do my best to come up with anything short of lethal violence to remedy the situation.
Do you want to say anything more about that situation, or do you want to go ahead now and take this up to the international level?
Well, there is a nugget left, and that is happens when it's clear that you're out of time. The guy has a gun. He's going to shoot.
Right.
And this is, I kind of see this as a thicket. Right there is there's a area at the boundary line between pacifism and some other option. For a Christian, the other two options that I'm aware of are just war and holy war. And I confess, I don't think I've seen my way all the way through that thicket. The book I've written about pacifism, an attempt to get in there and see what's happening right there at the very nub of some of these things. Now, first of all, I'll say that reduces the cases tremendously. Mm-hmm. But I think it's still true that pacifists need to be responsible and push through that thicket and say, well, what could Constantine have done? What could Peter do instead of cutting off the ear of the temple guard? The book looks at several of these kinds of dilemmas. So Peter, Constantine, the Quakers, 9/11, somebody on Flight 96.
Mm-hmm. 93.
Yeah. Flight 93. The first pacifist I look at, I mean, the first dilemma I look at is Jesus' dilemma in the wilderness being tempted by Satan. So that's one of mine. I think I'm missing one. Oh, Bonhoeffer and the Nazis.
The quintessential Nazi. Yes. You know, would you have resisted Hitler when you knew about the Holocaust?
I sent my book to a publisher. I'll leave the publisher nameless, but the editor gave me a very thoughtful response. A 2 or 3 page rejection letter, which I thought was fairly nice for a rejection letter.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out one of his concerns is he was a Bonhoeffer scholar, and he did not. I didn't know that, and I sent him the chapter on Bonhoeffer as one of my sample chapters, and he did not like my chapter because in the end, I say the tragedy of Bonhoeffer is he set himself up to be the precedent for terrorists, and I think that by itself is too much. I mean, it's enough to condemn Bonhoeffer's choice as a bad, poor one.
Discuss what you mean by that, because not all of our listeners are that familiar with Bonhoeffer, including myself. So go ahead and explain.
Well, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor and theologian. His career basically fits in between mostly the two world wars. And in the 30s, as Germany is descending into Nazism, he's one of the voices in Germany against this, resisting it, the believer's church type of thing. And he even has a chance to, a bunch of people in America invite him to America because they want to get him out of Germany. And he comes and he does his tour and then he goes back to their horror just as the war is about to descend on Europe. And during the war, he's actually involved in some espionage by resistors to Nazi. A group of people in the military and the intelligence in Germany are feeding information to England and the Allies. And under the cover of his church work, Bonhoeffer would travel and feed this kind of information about what's going on in Germany to the contacts he made while he was traveling. This is dangerous work to begin with, but that also puts him in touch with people who are very active in resisting Hitler underground on the sly, and including a group that decides they're going to try to kill Hitler. And so Bonhoeffer is actually on the fringes of the plot, one of the plots against Hitler. There was more than one. But he had been a pacifist. He had his convictions had been into the 30s that Christians could not kill. Which was a remarkable thing for a Lutheran pastor. And he wrote about this. And then when it came time to decide whether he would join the active part of this plot against Hitler, he found himself in a crisis, and he decided he had to step away from pacifism for this case. I don't know. We don't know exactly what this would have meant long term, because he didn't survive. He was captured and killed, executed just before the liberation of his prison camp in 1945. He wrote the ethics largely at the time in which he was involved with this plot. And if you read the ethics with that in mind, I read it once a long time ago and I thought it was an interesting book, but I didn't understand where he was personally when that did it. So I read it again recently with this in mind as I was preparing this book. And the ethics is a lot about the radical obedience to God, that a Christian's duty is to obey God as he understands it, wherever God takes him. God is sovereign after all. And our human understandings of ethics, including what to do about violence, so he kind of skirts around that to some degree because he doesn't want to give away what he's doing, I guess. All of our human systems of ethics, the very best ones are only rules of thumb. And we don't really understand the underlying reality the way that God does. And so when God tells us to do something, we can't let our preconceived notions of ethics stop us. And I read that now, knowing what he was doing at that time, as his working through, at least in part of what he was doing, was his working through his understanding of ethics about violence. And the fact that he felt he was being directly led by God to participate in the assassination of Hitler, one of God's creatures, one of God's redeemable creatures. We are no orcs in our world. These are real human beings that have the same love of God that anybody does, from God that anybody does. So, and he basically understands this as trying to be radically obedient directly to God's leading in his life. And he understands it. It's possible for him to be mistaken that evil comes in the robes of light, as something, an image like that is one of the ones he uses. Nevertheless, if he's convinced, and he was convinced, and he says, even though I be condemned by my actions, by the rest of my brothers and sisters in Christ who haven't experienced the leading I have, I have to follow the leading and accept the condemnation. They are right to condemn me from what they see, but I have right to follow God, which I find, I don't find the just war critique of pacifism, it's difficult, but I don't find it as difficult as the holy war critique, because this is basically a holy war approach to violence. God commanded, Dietrich Bonhoeffer says, God commanded me to participate in killing Hitler, and I had to obey.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that can be difficult. So, I mean, he definitely is up, as you described there, this thicket that pacifists have to deal with. So let's go ahead and take that to our contemporary thicket of terrorism. Yeah. And, you know, maybe bring this to the issue of holy war and what all this means here. So you've written extensively about terrorism. So just very briefly, give us a definition of what terrorism is so that we know what we're reacting to. What do you mean by terrorism?
Well, you asked earlier how terrorism, one of the things we could talk about is how terrorism differs from something else. And so I'm looking for five hallmarks of terrorism. First of all, of course, it's violent. I suppose it's possible to be a nonviolent terrorist. I think my kids do that from time to time. I tell them they've got no future because I wrote the book on terrorism, but they're unimpressed. The fifth graders are not that impressed by what you do at the office. So it's violent. I'm not sure if it has to be lethally violent. The eco-terrorists are terrorists in a way, if they may be terrorists without...
Damaging people's property, yes. Creating great hardship and pain for individuals, sure.
Yeah, well, and eventually that can lead to death. So, yeah, I mean, so violence. Secondly, it's politically motivated violence. The purpose of the violence is not to kill the people being killed. The purpose of the violence is to affect other people's behavior, particularly governments. And policies that the and programs that the government is doing, including whatever that governments might be, it's politically motivated to achieve a political aim. So it's not just criminal; it's not just personal vendettas. A third thing that I'm looking for is that civilians are the intended targets. I'm not sure that you would call it terrorism when the targets are soldiers. It seems to be that terrorism gets part of its quality and character from happening to people who have not joined a violent game, so to speak.
Yeah, they're
not involved in threatening anybody. They're not potentially any directly tools of this, of any kind of military or any other kind of attack. It's not, so you can't call it defense when you attack civilians. So it's got to be somebody who's not a combatant, whatever that means, in whatever setting. So the civilians are the targets. The fourth thing is that the goal is to operate through fear. I said it was that the targets themselves are not really the targets. They're a means to something else. And one of the horrific things about terrorism is that the actual victims of the terror are not seen by the terrorists as humans, really. They're just vehicles. The best victims are people who will suffer visibly in a conspicuous way. And so that suffering is designed to sort of enhance the fear that people will feel having experienced the terrorism. So, watch the terrorism. So that's why 9/11 was such powerful terrorism, because it got everybody's attention. And we were watching TV, where I was glued to TV for about 15 hours straight. I didn't go to bed, I hardly ate. And I wasn't the only one like that. And then I turned on the TV again the next morning, first thing I got up. So the point is that that was highly effective, because the people were suffering so graphically. We couldn't actually see the people, but we sure could imagine what was going on.
Yeah, definitely.
And some people saw pictures and videos of people falling out of the building because they jumped.
Right.
And so that, and then to put yourselves in the shoes of the people on the Flight 93 and what they had to, I mean, all that is spectacular terrorism, because the victims are suffering. And except possibly the Pentagon, even there, I don't think there was anybody actually, they were trying to kill anybody in particular. They just wanted to kill people in a visible way. So operating through. And the fifth thing is, and this is where you get to some controversy, is it's got to be lawless. And it's, now, you want to wonder, how can the first four happen in a lawful way? You know, violence against civilians for the purpose of accomplishing something else, you know. And I make a distinction that not everybody will make between what state actors do and what civilian actors, non-state actors, might do. I think it makes sense. It's actually essential for our understanding of the legitimacy of states, is to say, you know, there's somebody with a monopoly on violence, and they have on coercive violence, and they have a legitimate monopoly on coercive violence. That's the way we've structured our states. Pacifists don't like it, but that's the way we've structured our states. And it only works, Hobbes tells us this, Thomas Hobbes tells us, it only works as if there's somebody has the monopoly. In fact, Hobbes says once somebody gets the monopoly on legitimate violence, it becomes legitimate per se because they have a monopoly.
Yeah, in part, I just as a side note, going back to our discussion on the U.S. Revolutionary War, it's interesting that some of the justifications that were given by the people who would not have fought the war were basically saying, yeah, you know, that's legitimate authority. You might not like it, but God said that's the authority. You obey that authority. There might be other ways that you can, you know, do God's work. You're not supposed to disobey God's law, but if they say pay your taxes and you don't like your taxes, well, you pay your taxes when it comes down to it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea that we need to obey, Tob says if we don't obey the legitimate, the monopoly on coercive force, if we think that we can question it or challenge it or do our own thing, then we lead to anarchy. And anarchy is one of the, I think there are three at least, one of the classic forms of political misery.
Yeah.
And that's why I tied, for example, the rebellion against the king to is he as bad as no government at all? At that point,
the anarchy you've reached would have a been point, much worse. Right, right,
you've reached
right,
a point where you can legitimately, according to Hobbes, and I agree with this, legitimately change the government if the government's just as bad as if you had no government.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what terrorism is. And I think one of the other underlying aspects of all this that you don't bring out, but it is there underlying this, is that it's intentional.
Yes.
That there is some degree of planning. Oftentimes it seems random and chaotic. A bus blows up in the middle of a city and it just, there's chaos and that, but there is an intentionality behind that. And that intentionality gives rise to people who don't want to see that, who want to take the love thy neighbor and mitigate this kind of problem and say, how do we deal with this when there is somebody on the other side engaging in violence, politically motivated violence, where civilians are the intended target and trying to generate fear? They're intentionally doing that. So I raise that question to you. How does
a pacifist deal with this, but first let's start with, how has the United States dealt with it, and why are you not necessarily satisfied with the way the U.S. has either responded to this issue since 9/11 or, say, you know, back in the 1970s or 80s when you start to see hijackings, et cetera?
Well, I think that in order to respond to it, we need to understand as much as we can about why it happens. And it doesn't do any good to do something that's not addressing where terrorism comes from. And I think one of the ways I think about it is that terrorism has both a spiritual and a political dimension. And actually, this was an insight that came to me pretty much on the spot or during the day of 9/11/2001. Because when it became clear what they were doing, they were getting on planes and flying them into buildings. And not only were they dying, but all the passengers were dying who had nothing to do with their battle.
Right.
And all the people in the buildings were dying. And how could anybody bring themselves to do that? I mean, I just think of what state somebody would have to be in to do that. I mean, I get mad at people, but I would never. I mean, who could imagine doing something like that? And so it occurred to me pretty directly that this has to be a matter of what I'd call spiritual deformation. I mean, there's something wrong going on spiritually with their souls, essentially. Maybe psychological issues as well, but there's something wrong with their souls. And it seems to me that you can account for nearly all of it with just two dynamics. And one is what I'd call corrosive grievance, some sense that I or my people have been a victim of an injustice, and that sense is kind of central to how I understand the world now. It's kind of, we dwell on this issue. It becomes a major narrative in our understanding of who we are ourselves, who I am as a person, who my people are. And
is it a lack of being able to give grace to others?
Well, but there's a reason why. Because the understanding is that the victimization that they've occurred begin to understand as deliberate, as persistent, and so forth. And so I say it's sort of like a corrosive grievance. It sort of melts down like into the soul. It becomes sort of like what's those called? A black hole in the center of your, and your world begins to orbit around this understanding of what's happened to you and what's going on. I've never been there, but I've had times when I've brooded over something that's happened to me, and it's become very powerful in my life. Right. And that, so I guess I could sort of get a sense of where that kind of deformation would go if it was unchecked. And then along with it has to come a second thing, which is to understand that the people whom you blame for this, to see them less and less as human beings and more as something else. Yeah. And I think this happens both as seeing them as subhuman, so that they're evil and that their motives are venal and they just don't have any of the redeeming human qualities, and as superhuman, that they have powers way beyond the average person. When I traveled in the Middle East in 2002, as part of the research for the book about When the Rain Returns, about Israel and Palestine, and we heard more than once, mostly from Palestinian sources, about how easy it would be for America to fix the Palestinian-Israeli situation. I'm looking at that. I don't see how we'd ever possibly do it. But from some of the Palestinians, I'm not saying that they were terrorists or anything, but they had, in a sense, dehumanized America by making it bigger and more powerful than it could possibly have been in lives all over the globe. And both of the subhumanization and superhumanization, both are dehumanizing. So we don't see, to be able to do what the terrorists did, they had to not only think of the people on the planes and the people in the buildings as not really fully human, but as the whole country that they were attacking in this way. So that's the spiritual side. That's what happens inside the individual. Not everybody who has these things turns to terrorism. And one of the reasons is that some people see that they have alternatives. They can work through some system. They have a remedy somewhere, a nonviolent option. So there has to be sort of a sense of political despair that I don't have any way of accomplishing things through a humane channel, a nonviolent channel. So the people who come from do terrorism, they don't always come. I mean, we want to say they come from non-democracies, but that's not always the case. I mean, Timothy McVeigh was from the United States. But even Timothy McVeigh didn't think he had any way to affect whatever he was grieved about. I don't even know if I'm on top of what his grievances were. But he felt like he was powerless politically. And then you have to also, the fourth thing is, you have to have a belief in what I call the myth of effective violence. Now, I'm not saying that violence is ineffective. I'm just saying we tell ourselves stories about it that make that limit our creativity in one way and channel it in another way. So that people who believe in the myth of effective political violence say that if you really want to get something done, you do it violently.
Yeah. Okay. And our popular culture, all our movies are centered around that. Yeah.
Exactly. That's how the hero always does it. He at least punches somebody, probably shoots somebody.
Yeah, Superman, Batman, etc.
Yeah, right. Or throws them in the vat or whatever it is they do. For people in the Middle East, I think that it's very difficult to escape the myth of effective political violence because their history, especially recent, their history for a long time has shown that you get things if you're really good at military endeavors. And they have been on the short end of that stick in the last couple hundred years, 300 years or so, and seen the Europeans run their lives because the Europeans are better at fighting. And the Palestinian-Israeli conflict itself is compounded by the rock-solid belief that both sides have that the way you win is violence. The military, the Israeli military is one of the best in the world, maybe for its size, the best in the world, and efficient and effective, and they can explain their entire existence from independence on by the superiority of their military. Palestinians, same thing. Israelis are winning because they have a better military. When the Israelis finally pulled out of Lebanon, Hezbollah said, aha, our terrorism worked. And Palestinians and others said, well, yeah, they're right. That must be what happened. So you have this myth. It's constant. It's very hard not to contribute to it. When we had our revolution in America as a violent revolution, we put a seed, more than one, a whole field full of seeds of the myth of effective violence, which, again, as I said, the South harvested and replanted themselves, mm-hmm. and we've been doing harvesting and replanting it ever since.
And do you think that motivates our current response to 9/11? So our current response to 9/11 was, okay, find out where bin Laden and his minions are and go smash them.
Yes.
And so we headed out to Afghanistan and then shortly thereafter to Iraq. Is that part of what's going on?
Well, sure. I mean, we have it called structuration. I mentioned that before. Because we believe this, we have developed the biggest military anybody's ever seen. And since we have it, we're inclined to use it. And we have evidence to say, well, it's worked. I mean, we have this successful political system, and we've survived a lot, and we've moved to a leadership position in the world because we won 2 World War Wars, and we've won several other wars since, or been in other wars since. And so it's very difficult to resist this idea.
And let me ask you, and I'm going to probe you on the pacifist angle on this, because I know you're saying that, okay, this isn't quite the best way to do it, and I want you to answer why that might not be the best way to do it. But there was a Wall Street Journal article just a day or two ago. And again, we're recording this on the 14th of September. I think this editorial came out on the 12th or 13th. I'll try to remember to link to it on the website. But it basically says, well, the reason why we're seeing all these attacks on embassies and consulates around the world at this very moment is because the United States has shown weakness. It's not that, so you're arguing, well, strength can oftentimes be problematic in and of itself. But if you're already showing that strength, if you are in many ways, what I'm trying to say here is the myth of effective violence might actually become self-fulfilling.
Yes.
In that you go in there saying, we're stronger than you, so stop behaving badly. Stop blowing up our buildings and attacking our consulates. And you might get some reaction to that. And people say, okay, we're backing off. You guys are bigger than we are. You have bigger guns. And so we stop. But the minute you back off and show more forgiveness, that's when these new attacks could occur. What are your thoughts
It's a very difficult situation. If you look at the four things I've mentioned that feed into terrorism, you can see that there really are two really good ways of increasing the supply of terrorism. And one is to give in to terrorists, mm-hmm. because that doesn't do anything to humanize you or anything, but it, or not much, and it reinforces the myth of effective violence. So
on the side of the terrorists,
yeah,
right?
The terrorists say, "Hey, it's working.
We're working.
Let's
do it
some more."
Yep.
And so you can't give in to it. And on the other hand, if you try to eliminate it violently, unless it was possible to kill every terrorist and every terrorist family member and every terrorist neighbor and every terrorist friend down the street, you can't eliminate it because you create other terrorists, because you feed the sense of corrosive grievance, you feed the sense of dehumanization, those Americans are doing everything, and you feed the myth of political violence, and you haven't done anything to correct the lack of alternatives. A violent response in Afghanistan and Iraq might be effective in the short range to, in the case of Afghanistan, demobilize or incapacitate the Taliban. In the case of Iraq, to shut down one of the sources of funds for terrorists around the world. And an example, Hussein himself, an advocate, it would show him that that doesn't pay somehow, I guess. But it's only in the short run, because in doing so, you're going to have to be violent to people if that's you're going to use a military means, and you cannot draw a clean line around your victims. I think those are bad. I think it's very likely that drone attacks right now are worse in terms of this, because they're going to be even less clean. You're going to find people in their homes and their cars. There's always going to be family members who had no, children, non-combatants of different sorts, who are also going to be victims. And you're spreading it all over in communities all over the world. You can do it anywhere. So what's the lesson here? We need better drones than they've got. I mean, whatever the lesson is. And so you're going to splatter violence. And this is one of the reasons why the Palestinian-Israeli thing has been so intractable. The Israelis have had the upper hand militarily since 1967, at least. But they've never contained the impulse of terrorism against them by violence. It just keeps spattering it. For everyone you kill, you create more.
The interesting thing you mentioned about the drones and how we also were talking about the subhumanization, the dehumanization. I mean, to some extent, do you think that that just feeds into that attitude? Because now we're not... now if we're the Taliban, we're not fighting flesh and blood American soldiers. We're fighting a robot.
Yeah.
Right? And that just seems...
But they know that somebody's back with you using a joystick. I mean, it can't do anything to rehumanize the Americans in their eyes. And it's certainly not doing anything to humanize various Arab populations or Muslim populations in our eyes. So
here's the big payoff question. And we'll close up on our podcast here with this. And it's been a long time coming to get to this question, but it's been a fascinating discussion. Is how would you recommend that the United States responds to a 9/11, responds to attacks on embassies and consulates from your perspective of pacifism?
Well, I think you need to do it in ways that address the causes of terrorism. And I think our policy, for one thing, I think the promotion of more democratic systems is a legitimate American policy objective. I think it should be done nonviolently. I think it could have been done nonviolently in Iraq even, because you want to undermine the myth of political violence. And you also want to give those systems more roots in the culture so that they can be seen as more legitimate.
Why do you think the promotion of democracy would help to ameliorate many of those causes of terrorism that you mentioned?
Because it would give people a way of venting their grievance and getting some response to it that would be both less violent and more likely to actually address the grievance. Mm-hmm. Democracies have been very successful at reducing, certainly violence amongst them. It's hard to point to a democracy on democracy war in history, at least since the War of 1812, and then you'd have to count the British as democracy then, and maybe the Civil War, but again, very compromised democracy, at least on one side there. So it's hard to find. So the way the democracy opens up the whole civil society idea that there are other structures besides government and voluntary associations, private and business even, the commercial commercial sector, all these are ways of addressing human needs that don't involve violence. Mm-hmm. And you've got to get past authoritarian rule, which in order to survive has to suppress all these other ways.
And how do you do that? Because, again, the promotion of democracy in Iraq has largely been, we come in, smash what you have, and say, now rebuild, but make sure it's constitutional.
Or
you
have some kind, yeah.
Right, essentially that's what we have. And you know, one could debate on how effective it's working in Iraq. It certainly doesn't seem to be working in Afghanistan very well.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that option to come in and smash, or just like we did with Germany and Japan too, following World War II, how does one promote democracy without some kind of coercive backing? Do we become the city on the hill that Winthrop talked about as we're the shining example, and everybody will eventually figure this out and want to
that's
be like
how
us.
We did it for most of our history.
Yeah.
And
yes.
I would say that's the more effective of the means. Why would the Japanese and the Germans even be accepting the democracy? Because they'd been familiar with watching it. I'm assuming they've been familiar with watching the example. I mean, they already knew what it was. It wasn't.
Yeah, they had the Weimar Republic. They had the Toshiro democracy. And
well, but not that they had experienced it itself, but that they observed it in others.
Yeah,
that's
true. Yes.
And clearly, not everybody has to have experienced it to appreciate it, because you have all the refugees that flee to democracies because they're democracies.
Right.
And so you have what's going on in the Arab Spring, which is really fascinating for me right now. It's such a mess. Mm-hmm. But there is a strong nonviolent strain in it, particularly in the Egyptian example. And what's going on right now in Egypt with the demonstrations against the embassies that the Egyptian government has been sort of lukewarm about suppressing. I mean, they're right now in a crux in their development of understanding what democracy is. And I'm really fascinated to see how this comes out. I think there's a real chance that this experience of their outrage about the film about Muhammad and their desire to express that outrage, but to figure out how to do that now that they are responsible for their own polity and the Muslim Brotherhood and the President Morsi, if I said his name right, is struggling right now how to get the footing of doing something they never had to do before.
Yeah,
which is to respond to this and consistent with the democratic principles.
And that oftentimes has a very moderating effect on political movements. It's easy to be extreme when there's very little chance of you affecting anything.
Yes.
But when you're all of a sudden in charge of making sure that the, you know, trains run on time and the sewer systems are clean and et cetera, it changes. It changes your behavior.
One more thing I want to say about it is I think it's not just the government's job.
Yeah. Civil society, right.
Part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. But remember I said there are spiritual deformations that happen. Mm-hmm. And that's, for Christians, that's their job. The church's job. The body of believers' job. And working through Christian channels, maybe working through allies and other faiths that also sense the same deformation and are willing to try to address it. But that's not a government job per se.
Right.
And here's where, again, I think my criticism of pacifist churches in general, and the broader church as well, is that we've left it to somebody else to do our job. And our job is to try to do something about the spiritual deformation side, to rehumanize people's perceptions both ways across the lines. That's a private matter as much as a public matter. And specifically to deal with the idea of corrosive grievance, it seems to me, is a matter that needs to be done in the private sector, and particularly in the faith sector.
So not to be so much pacifism as withdrawing from the world, but pacifist in an active way of engaging the world a little
That's
bit
one
more.
Of the ways to be we should be engaging, yes.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on how to deal with this from the pacifist side?
Well, we need to stop the drone attacks. I can't. I mean, from pacifism, from a legal side, I just can't see the justification there. And I think what we're doing now is maybe getting short term gains, but we're building up. It's kind of a form of deficit spending. We are getting something now at the cost of an overhanging debt of terrorists and would be terrorists that we're creating, that will crash down on us in the next generation. And I think the danger is very similar to the danger of our Vince public debt. I mean, if we get our public debt too big, it's going to crash our system. If this debt of terrorist, overhanging terrorism is too big, then we won't be able to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And to return to the active role that Christians play in trying to rehumanize, many people, I think, who are listening are going to say, well, that seems like a pretty Pollyannish goal here, that the divide between Muslims and Christians is pretty big and it's getting bigger. So what do you see as the future for that and the success that Christians could make in terms of bridging this gap and trying to rehumanize?
It's going to have. I think the church in general needs to see this kind of work as part of its ministry in the way that it saw missions as part of its ministry. If you had gone to a Christian in 1750 and pointed out what they probably didn't even fully realize, all the unchurched populations in the world, just about all of Africa, most of Latin America. I mean, it's a huge job. How could anybody ever do it? What happened was there was a grassroots movement in the United States and in North America and England and other places where people said, well, we're going to do this by our church sending somebody. And you reproduce that effect thousands and thousands, millions of times, and you've got an African continent that's predominantly Christian now, and where most Christians are from the south of the southern
hemisphere,
nations.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
An immense transformation. It took generations, but it was an immense transformation. Well, if we could see peacemaking, including the addressing of dehumanizing hatred and correction of corrosive grievance or a remedying of corrosive grievance as a mission as important as spreading the gospel itself was, then you could get there. And you wouldn't be alone because you would have allies in the secular world. As I've said, business, commercial interests don't want this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's bad for business. Yeah.
And can themselves be humanizing influences. Government will be your ally, I mean, in most ways. They might be, the drone attacks and things like that will be counterproductive, but their impulse is the same. And so I think it could have a more synergistic effect even than the gospel missionary societies did.
And I'll leave off with this last question that I often ask my guests about the topics they're talking about. Are you pretty optimistic about this happening, or do you have a sense of pessimism about where we're heading over the next, let's say, two or three decades?
My faith says I can be optimistic. If I step away from my faith and look at it in a human sense, I think we're at a race, and I don't know how the race is going to come out.
Well, I say let's stick with the faith end of things and remain apathetic. And Ron, I want to thank you very much for talking about this very interesting and difficult topic with us here on Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.